Behind every life transformed by medicine is a story, one that often begins with an investigator with a fresh idea, an idea that turns into a study and that ultimately advances patient care. Only innovation can truly help our patients live longer, healthier lives. Hello, my name is Dr. Kristen Siamber, and I'm an associate professor of medicine at the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center. This is the monthly podcast of ACRU, the Cancer Research Network, whose mission is to establish the next level study for cancer research across the major disease groups. In this podcast, we want to hear the stories behind the innovative ideas and listen to the unique journeys of our researchers. Listen in as we explore the people and ideas of today's leading translational research. Welcome to the ACRU Transformative Research Podcast. My name is Dr. Kristen Siamber, and I'm excited to host this episode as we explore the stories and innovation of today's leading translational research. Our special guest today is Dr. John Strickler. Dr. Strickler is a colleague of mine in the field of GI medical oncology, someone I've known well for several years now, mostly through our joint efforts in ACRU, the sponsor of this podcast. Dr. Strickler is an associate professor of medicine at Duke University and member of the Duke Cancer Institute. He specializes in the treatment of gastrointestinal cancers with a focus on clinical trials. Dr. Strickler recently presented groundbreaking data on the MOUNTAINEER trial at the 2022 ESMO GI Conference in Barcelona just in July. We're hoping to take a behind-the-scenes look at this study, as well as John's involvement and leadership of this trial today. Dr. Strickler, I'm excited to talk with you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you today.
So, John, why don't you tell for our listeners a little bit about your path in medicine, what got you interested and led you to this career path, and specifically why GI oncology? I think everyone would like to hear a little bit about what led you to where you are today.
Like many of us, when we're choosing a career, we're looking for something that provides professional fulfillment, something where we can make an impact in our patients' lives, but also something where we can perhaps improve what we're doing. And I think one of my goals of my career is to figure out ways that we can move beyond what I consider to be a first-generation anti-cancer treatment, and that's conventional chemotherapy, into new therapies that use the best possible science to identify actionable targets and then find therapies that reach those targets and minimize side effects, ultimately with a goal to help our patients not only live longer, but live better. So giving them the best possible side effect profile and helping them to see cancer not so much as a death sentence, but rather as a chronic disease that they can live with. We've made a lot of progress in that respect. As in terms of how gastrointestinal cancers got into the mix, you know, when I was finishing up fellowship about, 12, 13 years ago, I was looking for faculty members to work with that had a similar vision for where cancer medicine was moving, and happened to connect with a wonderful mentor named Herb Hurwitz, who took me under his wing and really an extraordinary level of mentorship he provided, meeting with me weekly, supporting great ideas, telling me when I had bad ideas, and helping to make things better. And for me to be an oncologist, a junior oncologist in an environment where I was provided that level of mentorship and support was so important and is a big influence on what I've chosen to do in my career and the kinds of research I've done.
I can say from my experience too, I had a similar experience, and it's interesting to see, as we're both kind of mid-career now, how we can influence the younger generation too, and how really critical our mentorship can be. So now we're starting to be on the other side of it, John. not that it feels like we started very long ago, but I agree. I think mentorship is the key and can really be very impactful. Certainly another probably podcast episode in the future, we can talk about that. But it's also great to hear sort of the impetus behind you going into oncology and sort of, it's always so important, especially in our day-to-day, to keep the patients in mind, right? I mean, we don't just do this. Obviously, the science is interesting and what we do is really important. But at the end of the day, it's up to us and our colleagues and the science to really figure out how to make life better for patients. So I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to hear a little bit about your involvement with ACRU. So as you know, ACRU is a sponsor of this podcast, and it's a research consortium that I think we've both really benefited from, but also really, really enjoyed being a part of. So tell me a little bit about how you got involved in ACRU and what that's meant to you over the last few years professionally.
I first became involved in ACRU as a junior faculty member. And this is once again, that mentor that I just mentioned, Herb Hurwitz, he had strong relationships with the other ACRU, senior ACRU investigators. And I can remember very clearly that Dr. Hurwitz said, "Hey, John, we're going to go to this ACRU meeting, steering committee meeting, and I'd like for you to join me and meet some of these people and bounce some of your ideas off of these leaders in our field." And I remember showing up at that first meeting and being completely intimidated by the kinds of people who were in the room. And I had never really been in a room with these senior, highly published investigators who you always see up on the podium. And it can be a bit intimidating at first, but I'll tell you, it was a wonderful experience to be able to get in the room with them, start bouncing ideas off these people, and they make you a better oncologist. They make you a better researcher. They hone your questions. And that was my initial experience with ACRU. And then as some ideas of mine became a little bit more developed and it became clear that there was a path forward, these ACRU, senior ACRU investigators were wonderful champions for these research ideas that I had and helped to bring them into the clinic. So I'm very appreciative for the support I received, particularly as a junior faculty member trying to get a toehold in academia. To have that support from like-minded academic investigators was so important.
A lot of times we think about mentorship being within our institution, and that's clearly critical in our career development, but these external mentors can also be really helpful too. And I've had a similar experience through ACRU. And that was actually how I met you, I think, several years ago. I don't remember when we initially met, but early on, we definitely had a lot of meetings at ASCO and through the ACRU GI committee, and similar interest in precision medicine, particularly in colorectal cancer, which kind of brings us to the main focus of this podcast episode today, which is to talk about the Mountaineer study. So you recently presented data from this trial, which initially started as an investigator-initiated trial through ACRU, and you recently presented these data at major medical meeting. And so I'd like to hear actually a little bit about how the trial started. It's going back to what you said about as a younger investigator, kind of seeing these big name investigators on the podium. It can be hard, I think, starting out to really imagine how you get there and what the work is that goes into that. And really, frankly, how much time goes into that. So it's not something that happens overnight. But I think the Mountaineer study is a really interesting one in terms of how it's developed over time. And fortunately, I think will be potentially practice-changing data as well. So tell us a little bit about how that concept came to be, what you were looking at and what you were trying to, what question you were trying to answer, and we can talk a little bit more about that.
There's kind of a long story of how Mountaineer came to be. It was not the original intent of my research to have a HER2 study. So when I joined faculty at Duke in 2011, my mentor said, "Hey, John, why don't you get some experience as a principal investigator and work with a company for some MET inhibitors that they're developing?" And so MET was a very exciting target at the time. MET amplification is seen as a marker of acquired resistance to EGFR therapies. And I was trying my hardest to identify patients with MET amplification with colon cancer, and I couldn't find anybody. It was it was very difficult because, as we knew at the time, it was so difficult to re-biopsy patients. And it was just about the time that there was a little company in Silicon Valley that had just started called Guardant Health. And I remember walking up to the two founders at an ASCO meeting and saying, hey, tell me about this blood-based technology. Do you think you guys could find MET amplification in blood? And they said, yes, we can definitely find MET amplification in blood. So that became a partnership where I was profiling patients who had developed resistance to EGFR antibodies. They all had colorectal cancer. And I was creating a data set to identify MET amplification for these MET inhibitor trials that I was working on. Well, it just so happened that I was finding, completely by coincidence, finding a pack of ERBB2 or HER2 amplified patients. And at the time, there was some noise about maybe this is actionable based on some work out of Italy. And I found enough of these patients that I treated a patient with lapatinib and trastuzumab, the best HER2 therapies we had at the time. And this was even before Heracles was published, and saw an amazing result. So you talked at the very beginning, Kristen, about how patients are at the center of what we do. Patients inspire these research questions for me. I treated this N of one, had a wonderful response to lapatinib and trastuzumab. And I said, gosh, we need to make this more available for patients. This is definitely an actionable target. We're finding these patients now with our new blood-based NGS tests and also our new tissue assays at the time. So I wrote a quick letter to a little tiny company called Cascadian in Seattle, who had an exciting new drug called tucatinib. And I said, hey, I'm finding a group of these patients who have HER2 positive colon cancer. I wonder if your drug works in these patients. And we'll put it together with trastuzumab and it will be a chemo-free regimen. And they got back to me in about an hour and said, yeah, let's check it out. And I was obviously thrilled. Then the next question is, oh my goodness, how am I going to find all these patients that now I've promised to find? So that's where Accru came in. So I reached out to the Accru team, Dr. Vikai Saab and other senior investigators at Accru, and we put together a consortia of like-minded sites that are finding HER2-positive patients, and we launched the study in Accru, and the rest is history.
That's fascinating, and I love how it started with an observation, with something that you were looking at and sort of turned into a research idea that ultimately went on to impact patient care. So that's really exciting to hear. How did the name Mountaineer come about? That's an unusual name, and I'm curious if it has a backstory.
We at Accru, we like to have good names for our trials. And everybody said, John, you need a name for this trial. Tucatinib and trastuzumab for HER2-positive colorectal cancer, that's not a name. So I was really struggling for a while what I would choose. Now, the company that was funding this IST was called Cascadian, and they had a breast cancer trial called HER2CLIMB. So I knew it had to be a mountain theme, and I had to fly out to meet with all of the Cascadian people in Seattle. And the day before, I went up on a hike with my family to Mount Rainier, and we were walking around, and I was bouncing around all these names, and I had to put ONT in it because ONT-380 was the name of tucatinib back then. And I said to my wife, I think I might name my trial Mountaineer. Does that work? And she said, yeah, that sounds fine. So I showed up the next day at the meeting and I announced that it would be Mountaineer. And I was closely gauging all the facial reactions in the room to see if people would go for it. And I didn't see anybody look physically ill. So it was Mountaineer from that point forward.
I love that. That's hilarious. I don't think I knew that story, actually. So once you had this idea and you had some buy-in from the company and you knew that you were going to go through Accru, tell me a little bit about some challenges that you encountered as you were going through. And this study also had an interesting trajectory over time and how it developed beyond the investigator-initiated initial cohort. So tell us a little bit more about kind of the challenges that you went through and sort of what that looked like over time. And how long did this process take?
I think my initial worry with Mountaineer was, are we going to find these patients? Just to rewind back to the time at which we opened that study, it was NGS testing was entering the clinic. We were increasingly doing it, but it was not certainly not universal outside of academic centers. And, you know, and I was just worried we wouldn't be able to find all the 25 patients that we had signed on to find. So I talked to other investigators who were involved, and special thank you to Memorial Sloan Kettering, Andrea Sursik, and Kimmy Ng at Dana-Farber, as well as Dr. Bikai Saab, who really were champions at their own sites for the very early enrollment. But it became clear to me that we would not be able to identify all of the patients at our own sites, that these patients were going to be coming from everywhere across the country. And I was able to get connected to a Facebook group called Colon Town, which is a wonderful patient community where patients come together and they're organized by their molecular variants. And there just so happened to be a HER2 positive group at Colon Town. And they brought me in and they did a lot of the publicity nationally for HER2 positive colon cancer. And whenever a patient entered the group and they were interested in a trial, they would put me in contact with that patient. I would personally call that patient up. We had patients coming from all across the country to Duke initially, people traveling thousands of miles. But then the barrier you can imagine is, how are these people going to get here? Because they needed to come every 3 weeks for the trial. So kudos once again to the Cascadian team. They wanted to support it. And I literally reached out to the CEO and said, hey, our patients are traveling a huge distance to come here for this trial. Can you guys support it? And they said, we'd be happy to. So they reimbursed the cost of the travel so those patients would not be bankrupted by trial participation. So we had a large amount of enrollment at the site with patients flying in from all over until there were enough sites nationally where they wouldn't have to travel so far. So that was the challenge initially, finding the patients and then ensuring that they had the financial means to participate. That was kind of the initial, what I would call the initial step. And then, of course, the results were presented in 2019 and were quite strong. But it became clear that in order for us to go to the next level and show data that might be even potentially useful for FDA registration, we needed to scale up that study. And so we transferred the trial to the sponsor. And by that point, Seagen had purchased Cascadian. So they became the key sponsor and they took over the trial and really helped us ramp up enrollment dramatically so that we could present this data this year.
I think you've hit on some really key challenges that we think about when doing clinical research, especially in this era where many of our trials are no longer just for all-comer patients with colon cancer, but now are these increasingly small subsets, which on one hand is really great because we can target them, these tumors, more effectively. But you hit on the point that we're having to do the trials a lot differently now. No longer can we do single institution studies, you know, in such a biomarker selected population. And that brings in a whole host of challenges, as you highlighted, finding the patients, getting the patients to be able to travel, even just the compensation, that was huge, I remember, on this study. But a lot of credit goes to these patients who really sacrificed a lot to help us find the answer to this. So I love that you worked with Colon Town as well. I mean, we have such great patient advocacy groups. And I think social media has helped us connect even more. Twitter and Facebook and all of the different social media sites have been really key in helping us to kind of integrate patient care, clinical research, because really our patients are our best partners in many ways. Once the study was transferred to Seagen, and obviously there was a hint of activity, a really nice hint of activity early on, which made all of us excited who were participating in the study. But tell me a little bit about when the study was getting ready to really complete enrollment, and tell me a little bit about how you knew that this was really going to be potentially a game changer? And what were your thoughts, and how are you thinking moving forward, and what are the next steps for this regimen in colorectal cancer, do you think?
To one aspect of your question, which is, when did I know that this was going to be something big and potentially be practice changing? I knew it almost instantaneously with the very first patient we enrolled 4 years ago. And that was pretty exciting to see a person who's exhausted all standard therapies, where you've got a treatment that is dramatically reducing CEA. Person says, wow, I've never taken a treatment that I feel this good on. Like, sometimes you just know something's big. And so I knew it with that very first patient. And it became pretty clear to me, based on looking at the genetic reports, who was going to hit a home run with this, because there are some pretty predictable markers, which I'm sure we'll be presenting in the near future. In terms of coming over the finish line, clearly we faced that struggle that everybody faced during the COVID era of identifying the patients, having the staff to enroll the patients on trials. So we were able to work through all of the challenges that everybody has dealt with in 2020 and 2021. We had a target to present these results sometime in this year, in 2022, and we're very thankful that we could present that at ESMO World GI in July. Did require a late breaking abstract format, but we were able to get in under the wire. And what's exciting to me is, I think we all knew that this was going to work based on the data we had already presented in 2019. It was looking so promising. I think what's really blown me away about this, and something that will probably come out in the future, is the quality of life. The side effect profile is really very favorable. This is a highly targeted regimen, chemo-free. There are no treatment-related deaths, thankfully. In most cases, the side effects, when they're there, are pretty manageable. Rarely were we seeing dose reductions. But the other part of this story, which is still playing out, is, can we look at an NGS profile or a molecular profile for our patient and know that this is going to be the right regimen for the patient? And I think the answer is going to be yes, and look forward to telling that story as well, about who are the patients that are going to hit a home run with this, because the median duration of response on this study was really extraordinary, over a year median duration of response. And when you're pairing that up with a side effect profile that's so well tolerated, quality of life is so good, that is quality time that patient's going to have. So I think just telling that story is something that we're starting to do. We'll continue to do that, and look forward to telling it at some future conferences here.
I actually remember years ago when you had come to, whether it was ASCO or we were having an accrue meeting, and you were so excited about the initial data. And there were just a few institutions at that time participating in the study. And fortunately, we were able to add to that number. But I remember your palpable enthusiasm, which was so nice to see, and really is something that we're all trying to get for our patients. So I remember a similar experience when we had the initial pembrolizumab study for MSI high patients. And that was just on the cusp of understanding that that was a great predictive biomarker in colorectal cancer, as well as other tumor types now. But just to see how patients could do so well on a targeted therapy and really change the trajectory potentially of their life and their experience and their quality is really what we're all in this for, right? So we definitely look forward to hearing more from the Mountaineer study and what kind of is the spinoff from that and how we learn to better target our patients' tumors, not only, as you said, just for response and survival, but also making sure that we're emphasizing the quality of life too. So I agree. I think this regimen is really well tolerated. And that's been incredibly nice to see, because the last thing you want is, yes, this regimen works, but it's really awful for patients' lived experience. So we definitely don't see that that's the case with this one. Now, we're getting kind of to the end of our time, but I also wanted to, we always ask our guests, couple questions about what they do outside of medicine, and because we know that we're not always working as much as we feel like maybe we should be. So what are some hobbies that you have outside of medicine, or what's something that you like to do when you're not at work?
I have three kids, so there's very little me time involved. But the good, great thing about my kids is they come along for my hobbies. So we as a family really enjoy hiking. So we like to travel and go hiking in beautiful areas. And that's been something that I've enjoyed quite a bit. Obviously I live in North Carolina now, so not easy to do this hobby, but I grew up an avid skier and continue to ski every chance I get. And I also like to go jogging when I get some spare time. So I like to do all kinds of different things, but it usually involves the outdoors.
And I know from experience as well, our kids keep us very active, right? Yeah. So I know yours actually are into tennis as well. So keeping up with them, I'm sure, is another full-time job.
I do spend lots of time at small towns in the Southeast at tennis tournaments and get to ride the emotional roller coaster that is being a tennis parent.
It's totally different from when you go through it yourself, right? I mean, you have to hold yourself back.
Yes. It really does require all kinds of self-discipline to say things at the right time and be a supportive parent. Fortunately for me, my son plays a team sport. He plays soccer. So that one, a little bit easier for me to keep silent on that one for whatever reason.
I'm sure you're very busy. And finally, my one last question is there a book that you've read recently in all your spare time that you felt is pretty impactful or has caused you to think differently in any way?
I do try to keep up on my reading. I would not say that it's particularly life-changing. I recently read Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. I love it because it's just a really cool science fiction book that makes you think about life in the universe a very different way. And just a very clever story. So recommend that one for your listeners.
That's great to hear. I'll put it on the book list for sure. I have a stack of books next month that I have yet to read, but always looking for good ones. So thank you so much, John, for joining us today. I think this has been a wonderful episode. And I think what I love about this story, the Mountaineer story, is just hearing your experience from the very beginning, from the conception of the idea, all the way to really getting amazing trial results. And I hope that it's inspiring to younger investigators to utilize those observations that we see in clinic and those things. No idea is too small, because you never know where it will lead, and hopefully for the benefit of our patients. So thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our listeners for joining us today as well.